You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Nancy Solomon from WNYC's newsroom, in this week for Tanzina Vega. All right, you get the first word today. In the wake of the guilty verdict for former police officer Derek Chauvin in the murder of George Floyd, we reached out to you to see how you've been processing the news. And many of you had a similar message.
Hi, this is Ruth from Morrison, Colorado. The verdict was a huge relief, but I can't help but think about the decades of cover-up and lying and our police watching out for themselves.
My name is Diane. I'm calling from Dallas. How can we celebrate this one accountability when hours before Makaia Bryant, a 15-year-old girl, is gunned down by police? This is a crumb of accountability. Atiyana Jefferson's parents both died before seeing her murder even get a trial date. What is it really to cheer for? Black Americans are still being treated inhuman. This is not a celebration by far. It's an injustice to see accountability for just one police officer when there's so many others that don't receive accountability. Treat us the same way they treat each other.
Samantha McKenzie, I'm calling from Wilmington, North Carolina. It's so sad that so many of us were waiting with bated breath for the verdict to be read. It's a sad commentary, and it's the judicial system that has given us this impression where none of us thought that justice would be served.
My name is Mark Kaufman. I think it's important to note that the conviction of Derek Chauvin and the murder of George Floyd doesn't mean anything unless we face the immutable fact that all these black victims of police violence would be alive if they were white. That's the unspoken truth, and it's time that it's uttered and confronted.
A relatively rare guilty verdict for a police officer in the murder of a black American was a relief, but systemic racism is still embedded throughout our country's criminal justice system. That's been more than evident when you look at the number of police killings that took place during the trial of Derek Chauvin, and in the weeks since the jury's verdict was announced. According to the New York Times, at least 64 people were killed by police since testimony began in late March. In many cases, developments are still ongoing. Just last week, in the case of Daniel Prude in Rochester, New York, records were released showing that members of a grand jury voted overwhelmingly not to charge the officers involved in his killing. And in the case of Rayshard Brooks in Atlanta, the officer charged with murder has yet to head to trial. At the same time, the Department of Justice is launching its own investigations related to at least two of these cases. Attorney General Merrick Garland recently announced police probes in both Minneapolis and Louisville in connection to the killings of both George Floyd and Breonna Taylor. And while this might change the approach to policing in specific cities, many criminal justice reform advocates are emphasizing that more sweeping national reforms are needed to prevent the list of black Americans killed by police from growing. With me now to discuss all of this is Aaron Morrison, national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press. Aaron, great to have you back on the show.
It's good to be back.
And also with us is Shyla Dewan, criminal justice reporter for the New York Times. Shyla, thanks for being here as well.
Thanks for having me.
So, Shyla, let's start with you. Let's go through a few updates on some of the high-profile cases that rose to prominence during last summer's racial justice uprisings. Remind us about the details in the Ahmaud Arbery killing and where things stand with the men indicted in that case.
Sure. Ahmaud Arbery was shot in a community near the Georgia coast by civilians who some of whom were former law enforcement. He was jogging through the neighborhood. They believed he was suspicious and may have committed a robbery or burglary, and basically chased him down. And, you know, not surprisingly, he struggled against them and they shot him. So that case is yet to go on trial, but there are three people charged. And what's interesting about that case is that they are actually in jail awaiting trial. That's somewhat unusual in some of these cases. We've seen police officers get released on bond. And in this case, the judge has repeatedly declined to release the three men charged.
And is that one just proceeding apace, or have there been delays in it?
I don't think there's been any undue delays. A lot of times it takes a long time to prepare for trial in cases like these. In fact, the Chauvin case was surprisingly fast to come to trial in my mind.
Okay, so tell us about the trial of Garrett Rolfe, the former Atlanta police officer who shot and killed Rashard Brooks last June. That's the one that took place in a Wendy's parking lot. Why is that one taking so long to get started?
Well, that one has run into legal problems. And the district attorney, Paul Howard, who filed the charges against the police officers and then used some of the footage, I believe, in his campaign ads, he was running for re-election at that time. He was defeated. And the new prosecutor who's taken over the case has said, you know, I don't think my office can try this case, and has basically tried to give it to the attorney general. And I don't believe the attorney general has accepted the case. It's sort of become a hot potato in Georgia. The case has significant hurdles when you're looking at what you're going to tell a jury. You know, it may be that prosecutors are not eager to try that case.
Mm. Okay, let's talk about one more. There was news earlier this month about Rustin Shusky, the police officer in Kenosha, Wisconsin, who fired 6 bullets into the back of Jacob Blake last summer, leaving him paralyzed. Shusky will not be disciplined and was able to return to his job. So what happened? Why was he allowed to return like that?
Right. They declined to bring charges against him. And I think that highlights a problem with a lot of these cases, which is that what we allow police officers to do legally is often does not comport with what we expect as a community ethically. And so in this case, there were elements present which provide a pass for police officers. Oftentimes there was a presence of a weapon, even though it was very unclear that he was brandishing that weapon at all, and his lawyers say that he was not. The presence of a weapon is something that often provides cover for police to use deadly force, or in this case, slightly less than lethal force. Mm-hmm. So that is, they just said, we're not going to charge him. When they said that, they cited Jacob Blake's history of domestic violence. And this is another thing you see happening where prosecutors will look at the history of the victim, even if the police officer on the scene did not know that history. And I'm sorry, I should say, correct myself, when I say history of domestic violence, I mean history of accusations of domestic violence.
Okay. Well, Aaron, let's bring you into this. Following the guilty verdict for Derek Chauvin, the U.S. Department of Justice has now announced that it's going to be investigating both the Minneapolis Police Department and the Louisville Police Department. That's the agency that killed Breonna Taylor. Why are these investigations being announced now?
Well, I think part of the reason is because pretty much during the entirety of the Trump administration, there were no new DOJ investigations into police misconduct, or what they call pattern or practice investigations into police departments. And so what we're seeing right now is really just a restart of an effort under the Obama administration and prior to the Obama administration, in which the federal law allows the DOJ to go into local police departments and investigate any sort of violations of the Constitution and any practices that, basically violate citizens' rights.
Do we have any sense yet of what the investigations are going to look like? What exactly are they going to be investigating?
Yeah, so it's almost like, and I hate to use the word autopsy, but it's almost like an autopsy of a police department. It's not to say that the police department is dead, but you know, it's it's essentially saying we're going to go in and just do a really fine, really fine tooth comb through all of your practices, your hiring, use of force, arrests, racial data around, you know, who gets tickets, who, all of the things that a police department would do, a police agency would do, all of that gets reviewed by the DOJ and specifically the Civil Rights Division. You know, if you're familiar with this practice or these investigations, it's because you've heard of it before. They did that in Ferguson, Missouri, after the shooting death of Michael Brown. And what the DOJ found was that there was a pattern of practice of police there conducting stops without reasonable suspicion, disproportionately stopping African-American residents of that St. Louis suburb, you know, and also not just in the policing practice, it was supported by the municipal court in Ferguson. So we're talking about they found a focus on using police to drive revenue and basically create debtors prisons where folks who had tickets for jaywalking or not, you know, adhering to some sort of municipal ordinance, they were racking up debts. And if they didn't pay those debts, that could get them in jail. They could get them jail time. So that's just some of the things that a DOJ investigation into a police department can uncover. And I think that's why one of the reasons why you're seeing that now is because there is a real push among advocates and the public to crack down on these long, unfair, and biased police practices.
And what was the outcome in the Michael Brown case after that investigation? Like, then what did it, you know, what actually happened after they found all that wrongdoing?
So the results generally after these findings can be mixed, but what the Justice Department can do is essentially enter into an agreement with that city or with the police department, and it's called a consent decree. And this installs a federal monitor to say, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to reform. You're going to change training practices. You're going to get better at reporting arrests and things like that. And you know, often that can lead to some change locally, but not widespread.
So, Shiloh, we were talking about the new Department of Justice investigations in Minneapolis and Louisville. The FBI has also announced this week that they'll be conducting a civil rights investigation into the police killing of Andrew Brown Jr. in Elizabeth City, North Carolina. What's the difference between the FBI's investigation and the Department of Justice? How do those differ? Because isn't it all Department of Justice in the end?
Well, the FBI is investigating a specific case, and that would give them the potential to bring civil rights charges against the officers involved. What the DOJ is doing is called a pattern and practice investigation. In other words, not one killing, not one botched raid, but does your department have policies that discriminate, that lead to routine violations of people's civil rights? So those are two different things.
Do you have any sense of whether this is going to pressure local officials? I mean, you know, in the Andrew Brown case in Elizabeth City, they have yet to release much information about that shooting. That's the one where he was shot from behind through the rear window of his car. Does this kind of a thing with the FBI involvement, does it clamp down on things, or is it going to open it up more? Do you have any sense of that?
I think that what's putting pressure on local officials is the people, the protesters in the street, the activists, the advocates. They have really moved the needle in terms of what prosecutors are expected to do in the case of police violence. And, you know, we've seen cases in the past where families have waited months or even years to see the body cam footage of their loved one's death. And now we're hearing just, you know, that is not acceptable anymore. And I think police departments and mayors have a new playbook. You saw this with Dante Wright, who's killed in the Minneapolis suburbs during the Chauvin trial. You could almost see them holding this brand new script in their hands when they addressed that event. And handling it very differently from before. And I think that's the result of the people on the street and not necessarily what the FBI is doing.
Mm. Well, change is good. We could say that much about it. So, Aaron, you talked about the Department of Justice taking up more cases now that we have Biden in the White House. Is that also true for the FBI, or did we see the FBI get involved in any of these cases of police violence during the Trump administration?
So what often happens, and this is true not just for police shooting cases, but the FBI will often offer local law enforcement its assistance with resources and helping them investigate, a case that either is getting a lot of attention or is bubbling up to the national cases that we've come to know. But it doesn't always mean that it's because the local police department or the local law enforcement agency has done something wrong, but it can. In the case, I think it's safe to say that in the case of the Elizabeth City shooting of Andrew Brown Jr., the FBI is coming in because there are some concerns about how, just in a few short days, how the local law enforcement apparatus is investigating whether or not it's being fair and how it interacts with the family of Andrew Brown Jr., whether it's being transparent. So I think there are cases where the FBI just comes in and say, hey, we want to give you some help. There are also cases where the FBI says, hey, we have some concerns, and so we're going to do our own investigation.
And what about from the perspective of the advocates and activists? What are you hearing from them about, the spate of killings post-Chauvin verdict? What are their next steps and strategy going forward?
Well, people thought that maybe with the Chauvin verdicts that some of the activists who had been calling for the defunding of police would maybe back off or sort of ratchet down their rhetoric, but that's not been the case. What we know is that one individual officer being convicted can send a signal, certainly, to police officers across the country. But it does not mean that you can expect that things will be done differently all across the country. There are 18,000 police agencies or law enforcement agencies that operate in the U.S. And so the idea that change can happen as a result of what happened in Minneapolis can't be absent of federal sweeping legislation or reforms that would spur some of those and really encourage local police departments across the country to do things differently.
It's also been surprising to me to see this the Republican backlash and the targeting of protests as the criminalization of protesting rather than a heartfelt response to stopping this problem. Do you think, is that going to have a chilling effect, these new laws that are coming into place that put more criminal penalties up there?
I think that is going to have some impact, but generally, I mean, the diehard folks, particularly those in the Black Lives Matter movement who've been in the streets for years, I don't think you're going to find that they're going to stop hitting the streets as a result of these new laws that are cropping up in places like Oklahoma and other jurisdictions that are really focusing on this idea that there's a threat to law enforcement when protesters use their First Amendment right to demand better from their government. There's more likely to be legal civil liberties groups like the ACLU and others coming to aid these protesters if they do face criminalization for protesting.
Okay, I'm afraid we're going to have to end it there. Aaron Morrison is a national race and ethnicity writer for the Associated Press, and Shyla Dewan is a criminal justice reporter for the New York Times. Thanks to you both for coming on the air and speaking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
India is in the midst of a severe second wave of coronavirus infections. Today, the country reported more than 360,000 new cases for the sixth consecutive day, and the death toll has passed 200,000. Some hospitals and medical facilities have been overwhelmed by people seeking treatment and have stopped admitting patients as they struggle with limited supplies of medicine, oxygen, and ventilators. And less than 2% of the country's 1.4 billion citizens are fully vaccinated. With me now to talk about all this is Hari Kumar, reporter in the New Delhi Bureau of the New York Times. Hari, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thank you very much.
So, I mean, this is truly heartbreaking. Tell us what you're seeing on the ground there.
So what we are seeing on the ground here in New Delhi is that every infrastructure, every facility related to health and related to death is crumbling under pressure. So as far as health is concerned, people are finding it difficult to get the hospital beds. If they get hospital bed, that they are not getting oxygenated bed. If they get oxygenated bed, then they are not getting ICU bed. If they're getting ICU bed, then they are not able to get ventilator bed. Secondly, the corona-related medicines are very much in short supply. There is a medicine called remdesivir, and there is a huge amount of blackmailing going on in the undermarket for that medicine. Then there is another medicine called Fabiflu. The Fabiflu is not easily available. In the open market, oxygen cylinders are not easily available. The oxygen concentrators are not easily available. The ambulances are not easily available to the people. And the providers are charging very high price for those services. About death. People are in the queue to bury, to cremate their dead bodies, of their family members, and there is a shortage of platform, and there is a shortage of wood to cremate the body. So every infrastructure related to health and related to death is crumbling under pressure in New Delhi today.
You know, it wasn't too long ago that India was doing well in terms of dealing with the pandemic. So what changed? What happened to create this problem?
Well, experts say that this is the new strain of coronavirus. This is a double mutant. Its infectiosity is very high. So it is infecting the people with a very high rate, but the death rate is as same as it was earlier. So if the earlier virus was infecting one infected people can infect 10 or 20 or 30 people, this new strain, which is called double strain, can infect 200 people, 300 people. So because of that, I mean, if an virus comes to your house, then it will infect the whole family. Even the young children are getting infected. That was not the case in the earlier. And then the nature of the disease and the nature of sickness has also changed. So many more symptoms. There is a temperature to the people for prolonged period. 10 people are sick for 10, 15 days. Earlier people are sick for 3-4 days. And within 7-8 days, they will be all right. But that's not happening now. So many people are holding the hospital beds for long and everybody needs oxygen. So this second wave is entirely different in comparison to the first wave.
And I've read that the 300,000 new cases reported each day of the past week, that that's actually believed to be low and that there are missing numbers. Tell us about that.
There are missing numbers in the daily positive cases and there are missing numbers in the daily deaths also. The latest in the last 24 hours, the number of positive cases is 360,000. And the number of deaths in the last 24 hours are 3,293. Now, many experts say that the actual numbers are 2 to 5 times higher than this number. So because in India, the testing is very much under pressure. And because now the infectious is spreading in the countryside also, in the villages, in the rural areas. So many people are not getting tested. They are getting sick. Some of them are dying. Some of them are getting all right. And they are not coming anywhere in the record. So that's why the many experts say that the actual numbers are 2 to 5 times high. And there are some efforts on the part of the government also to underreport particularly the underreporting of the death cases.
Hari, you talked about the government underreporting cases. Tell us more about the role of the government and Prime Minister Narendra Modi in all of this.
The Prime Minister Narendra Modi has created a very centralized structure to deal with the disease. Lately, now they have given powers to the state that the state government can take their own decisions. But earlier, it was a very centralized structure to deal with the pandemic. And I think very quickly, they came into the self-congratulatory mode earlier this year that, okay, we have won over the corona and the corona is the end game in India. And that complacency and that relaxed attitude, that lowering the guard by the government and by the people, now the country is paying a very heavy price for that thing, the relaxing the things. So some of the facilities were wound up, no extra facility for the oxygen were created, and now the country is paying a very heavy price for that.
India is the world's leading vaccine provider, but from my understanding, less than 2% of its population has been fully vaccinated so far. So what's going on with the vaccination process and what are the problems getting those shots into arms?
Well, up till now, India has given one or two doses of vaccination to 147 million people up till now. And India is giving those doses to 2 to 3 million people every day. It's not a small number, but considering the India, when we are 1.4 billion people, so considering that huge number, among that number, look, those numbers look small. And now it looks that the supply of vaccine is under pressure. And many places, vaccine doses are exhausting and people are waiting in the queue. So we are having problems in our vaccination problem, in our vaccination program. It's a huge problem. We say all these things, but considering the vast scale of pandemic, no amount of preparations would have been complete preparations. And nobody, no system can prepare for such kind of a vast pandemic, whether it is hospital facilities. So some amount of crumbling and some amount of under pressure was bound to be there, whether it is vaccination, hospitalization, oxygen, etc., etc. But because India very quickly lowered their guard, India very quickly came into a relaxed mode, Indian government came very quickly into self-congratulatory mode, now country is paying a heavy price for this.
And how are Indians, both those who've been infected and those who are trying to avoid the virus, coping with the surge?
Well, the people are really living under fear. The anxiety levels are very high. People are less moving outside the home. And everybody is in dilemma, what to do, when it will end, how we deal with the situation, if I get sick, whether I'll get a bed or not, if I get sick, whether I'll get oxygen or not. So all these kind of psychological issues are coming to the people, depressing mood, sense of fear, enhanced anxiety. All these things are there, and particularly in the India's big cities like Delhi, like Bombay, like Bangalore, like Chennai, Kolkata. This is the mood in general of the people. And now because it is spreading to the countryside, nobody knows where it will stop and what will happen tomorrow.
And are the streets, are they kind of empty and are people staying at home or is there still a lot of public life going on?
Well, depends upon which city, because several cities have imposed a lockdown condition. Several cities have imposed a restricted movement. Several cities have imposed a curfew. So that's not all over the country. So depending upon which city we are talking about, for example, Delhi, you'll find the streets deserted because the Delhi is under curfew now. But yes, in many big cities, the streets are deserted, but not all over the country.
And how has the international community responded and what kind of help are you getting and what's needed?
At present, India needs mobile hospitals, India needs mobile manufacturing oxygen plants, and India needs ventilators, India needs oxygen concentrators, and some of the critical medicines like Fabiflu and Remdesivir. So now, in last 2-3 days, we are seeing that a whole lot of offers from the international help are coming. A lot of stuff is coming from America, from Gulf countries, from Japan, from European countries. So now the international help is very much geared up. A lot of oxygen cylinders are coming, a lot of oxygen concentrators are coming, and lots of those cryogenic trucks are coming, which transport the oxygen, because that's very much in shortage in India. And that will be helpful in dealing with the situation.
Hari Kumar is a reporter in the New Delhi Bureau of the New York Times. Thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you very much.
This week, the Supreme Court agreed to hear a landmark case that may transform gun laws in the country as we know it. The case, New York State Rifle and Pistol Association, Inc. versus Corlett, will answer the question of whether New York's laws on concealed carry gun licenses violates the Second Amendment. And this has the potential to affect other state gun laws around the country. The case is taking place with gun violence front of mind for many of us. As of Monday, there have been 160 mass shootings in the U.S. since January. Here to help us understand the case and its implications is Ian Millhiser, senior correspondent with Vox and the author of the new book, The Agenda: How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Ian, great to have you back.
It's good to be here. Thanks so much.
So give us the basics of this case. What exactly is being argued here?
Sure. So this is a challenge to New York's concealed carry permitting law. New York law requires you to show that the word in the law are proper cause to obtain a gun permit. And you can obtain that for a lot of reasons. If you're like a shop owner and you're afraid that someone might try to knock over your shop, you could have a gun, but there might be a restriction on your permit saying you've got to keep the gun in the shop. If you're like a bank messenger, if you're someone who like carries large stacks of bills back and forth between banks, there's obvious reasons why you might want to be armed. And so you could get a permit saying while you're on the job, you can have that gun. But the state is very reluctant to grant unlimited carry permits. You have to show that you have some sort of special fear of violence that goes beyond the general public. So if you just want a gun because you think you might someday be a victim of a violent crime, that's not enough. If you have a stalker, that might be enough because that would set you aside from the general population. Essentially, what the plaintiffs want in this case is they want a world where virtually anyone can get a permit and can get a permit without restrictions. So you'd no longer have to show proper cause. You'd no longer have to show that you had any kind of special need. You just, you know, go and say, hey, I want a gun permit, and you'd probably be able to get one.
And these New York State gun laws, how prevalent is this around the country in terms of states that have these kinds of restrictions on when you can carry a gun?
I mean, they're still fairly common. I mean, you know, in states controlled by Republicans, the trend is often towards making it easier and easier and easier to get guns. And in states controlled by Democrats, you know, restrictions have tended to remain in place. But, you know, this idea that not just anyone can carry a concealed firearm isn't particularly unusual, and it's particularly isn't unusual in cities. In urban environments, I think people tend to have a lot of fears that you interact with a lot of people and you don't want, you know, every person you run into on the street to potentially have a Glock under their jacket.
Tell us a bit about the people who are bringing the case. You know, who are they and what's their best argument that they've got?
Yeah. So the New York State Rifle and Pistol Association is basically the New York State equivalent of the NRA. So this is a, you know, this is a big gun rights group. Honestly, their best argument is that they've got the votes. So the history here is that up until 2008, the Supreme Court said that there wasn't an individual right to bear arms under the Second Amendment. It wasn't until a case called DC v. Heller in 2008 that the Supreme Court said that there is this individual right. But Heller has a lot of caveats. You know, it says that there can still be bans on what are called dangerous and unusual weapons. There could be bans on felons and people with mental illness carrying guns. There can be bans on guns in what are called sensitive places. You know, there's just still a lot of gun laws that are allowed under Heller. And this whole time since Heller was decided, there has been a crew of dissenting judges in the lower courts who've been pushing for greater and greater restrictions on state gun laws. One of those judges is Brett Kavanaugh. Another is Amy Coney Barrett. And so really what's going on here is just that, you know, the crew of judges that have been pushing to have a very expansive view of the Second Amendment now have power. And they have, you know, there are six Republicans on the Supreme Court. And so I think that this case is going to come down, it's likely to come down less to the quality of the arguments and more to just the brute force of the fact that, you know, the gun rights groups have the votes.
And is that the sum total reason for the timing that this is coming forward at this moment? Was there sort of, was the NRA kind of lying in wait for their majority on the Supreme Court to bring a case like this?
So gun groups have been bringing cases pretty consistently to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court's really been swatting them down. I mean, it's actually very unusual that, you know, Heller was this sea change that completely changed our understanding of the Second Amendment, said for the first time there's an individual right. And then since Heller, the Supreme Court said virtually nothing about what the Second Amendment means. You know, the lower courts have built up a framework, but the Supreme Court has, you know, done very little to flesh out what it meant by Heller. And I think the reason for that is for most of the post-Heller era, the balance of power on the Supreme Court was held by Chief Justice Roberts and by Justice Kennedy. And Roberts and Kennedy, I think, just don't care that much about guns. You know, you had some members of the Supreme Court, Justice Thomas was the most vocal, who were saying, hey, we need to take more guns cases. You know, let's flesh out Heller. Let's, you know, have a more expansive Second Amendment. But they were sort of screaming into a void. And what has changed isn't that the gun groups have suddenly start bringing cases. It's that now they have the votes on the Supreme Court, not just to win their cases, but they actually have enough votes to get the Supreme Court to hear this case in the first place.
If the NRA wins the case, then what's the next step after that? Or what do you expect to see? I mean, do we just see state gun laws around open carry falling across the country?
So it matters a lot what the opinion says. I mean, you know, the short answer is that every, you know, court in the country will be bound by whatever is in the Supreme Court's opinion. But I think given the Supreme Court that we have right now, I think they're going to take a very expansive approach to the Second Amendment. We're going to see a lot of gun regulations fall. And certainly, I think that, you know, throughout the country, it's probably going to be the case that virtually anyone can obtain a concealed carry permit.
Ian Millhiser is a senior correspondent with Vox and the author of The Agenda: How a Republican Supreme Court is Reshaping America. Ian, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
In the recent Disney Plus series, The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, actor Anthony Mackie plays Sam Wilson, better known by his superhero alias, Falcon. He picks up the mantle, or rather shield, of Captain America.
I'm a black man carrying the stars and stripes. What don't I understand?
Every time I pick this thing up,
I know there are millions of people out there who are going to hate me for it.
Mackie's Captain America is part of a new wave of black superheroes on the big and small screen, as well as splashed on the pages of comic books in recent years, from Marvel's 2018 blockbuster Black Panther,
Wakanda forever!
To HBO's critically acclaimed Watchmen,
I wear the mask to protect myself,
to Netflix's The Umbrella Academy.
I heard a rumor that I get it in one take.
I heard a rumor that you think I'm perfect for this
role. I heard a rumor that you love me.
For more on this, we're joined by Adilifu Nama, a professor of African American Studies at Loyola Marymount University and author of Super Black: American Pop Culture and Black Superheroes. Adilifu, great to have you with us.
Oh, it's good to hear your voice, and it's good to be heard.
Let's start with the introduction of the new Captain America in the recent The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. I mean, that's pretty significant to now have a black man wielding the iconic Star-Spangled Shield, right?
Oh, certainly. I think it's even it's iconic as well as relevant. It's relevant in terms of the moment that we as a nation are grappling with in terms of our own identity and mission and moral, you know, grounding. And so there's a way in which these broad pressing issues are being played out in a very interesting way with the symbolic representation of these issues by the Falcon and Winter Soldier Marvel series.
People that watch the new series know that Anthony Mackie's character, Sam Wilson, had a complicated journey in becoming Captain America. Well, tell us about that. What was the source of the inner conflict, and what does that represent?
Well, in many ways, I think we have to make a distinction between the television series and the comic book narrative in terms of its origin story. But it may be there is a distinction in terms of the way in which Sam Wilson becomes Falcon. But in terms of the ongoing discussion around American patriotism, the ongoing discussion around the place of race in that discussion, is something that the Captain America and Falcon comic book series was doing decades, in fact, prior to what we are witnessing with the television series.
And can you tell us a little bit about, you know, what that was, the conflict and how he goes through this transformation?
In terms of the series, and that tension has primarily been around Sam asserting his identity as a black man. And that was the case with the comic book series. And so it's very interesting, you know, for me as a fan of comics and as certainly as a cultural critic, to see this type of racial dialogue get the type of attention that is usually associated with, you know, some type of racial movement or racial scholarship. And now we're starting to see the best of what comics and a comic narrative can bring to our type of like popular understanding and discussion of these broad issues, that we get to see this through the prism of a comic book. And I think in that way, Sam Wilson's taking on, as you said, the shield of Captain America becomes a part of a broader debate about what is the role and place of black folk in American society.
Captain America is part of a wave, as we're talking about, of new black superheroes in movies, TV shows, comic books. So let's talk about some of the other notable characters. Did this start with the Black Panther, or does it predate that as well?
Well, I think really, if you want to talk about superheroes, I think we can really talk about, you know, John Henry, right? We can go to black, you know, the steel driving man, right? And so there's black folklore that has always, you know, we can find superheroes within a black cultural context. So I don't want to assign the origin story of the black superhero to one particular decade, one particular comic book company. But having said that, Marvel and DC are probably, you know, these are the mainstream iterations in which black folk take on the mantle of superheroes. And so that comes about in the 60s, which is not really surprising, right? Because the 60s is the backdrop of the civil rights and black power movement. There's an assertion of black people for their space and an assertion of their identity as not just subservient, not just oppressed or marginalized. And so that political assertion, I would argue, translates into a reimagining of what blackness is and can be. And so it's not surprising then that we see a reimagining of blackness beyond butlers and maids. We see a reimagining of blackness beyond sharecroppers and criminals. We see a reimagining of blackness as black folk with superpowers and abilities. And I would argue that this is not possible in 1920s America. This is not possible in 1940s America, because if those for the superhero aesthetic to work for black folk in that time frame, there's no telling what might come out in a 1920s version of this, right? We might have a Watermelon Man, right? And so there's a way in which the civil rights movement, the black power movement, the black freedom movement in total has a impact on how we imagine blackness going into the late 1960s and early 70s, where we see even a new crop of black superheroes emerging.
It's interesting, the parallels between, you know, the 1960s civil rights movement and the moment that we're in now. That's a very interesting parallel. One of the most striking things about The Falcon and The Winter Soldier is the inclusion of the character Isaiah Bradley. He's one of several black men who were experimented on as part of the U.S.'s super soldier program during World War II. What do you make of pop culture rooting characters and storylines in history, like the Tuskegee syphilis study in this case? I mean, that is a real thing. And so it's interesting that this show is referencing, you know, not fantasy, but actual fact.
Yeah, it gets you a little tongue-tied sometimes in terms of all the issues that are just folded in and compounded with that figure of Isaiah Bradley. So I would argue, yeah, it's making reference to the Tuskegee experiment in terms of the way in which syphilis was allowed to continue and attack these black, you know, I guess, guinea pigs without their knowledge. And so we see a similar framing with the Isaiah Bradley character. But the Isaiah Bradley character, I would argue, we don't want to just reduce him to that particular episode of savage experimentation. But Isaiah Bradley is a metaphor for the inclusion and exclusion of blackness in terms of contributing to the society, and the way in which the cost of our quest to be a part of the society on equal terms, there is a cost, and this cost is portrayed and presented by Isaiah Bradley. So he becomes a metaphor for the cost of enslavement. He becomes a metaphor for the cost of Jim Crow. He becomes a metaphor for the cost of trying to create space for a more equitable policing in our community. So there's a cost, and he is not only symbolizing that, but he expresses it in terms of, I served this country, and yet this country has not served me, right? And so that's a very powerful point of examination for a comic book, right? And that's what makes it interesting, that dynamic.
Yeah, and it's just, I mean, it's been such a familiar trope in superhero comics, the sort of the lab experiment gone wrong. And it just, to me, it's so striking that, you know, here you have an instance where this is really what happened, and it's referencing real history, and it makes it, I mean, it's so much more believable then.
Right. And this is what, let's jump into some of the heart of this. And this is, I think, the surprising element of why comics have become, or Marvel and DC, but particularly the Marvel platforms have become, they've resonated so much at this time. Because these comic book series and iterations allow us the opportunity now to talk about very tender and sensitive issues in a way that allows us to engage in a more provocative debate. And the Falcon Winter Soldier series is particularly attuned to this. And I would have to, you know, maybe attribute that to the inclusion of black folk in the writing room, the inclusion of black folk in the process of to make sure that the narrative notes and issues concerning race are articulated with the type of maturity that it deserves. And I think that's in many ways why we come to the Isaiah Bradley character, because he in this context is becoming a type of challenge, not only to Sam Wilson, not only to the Falcon, but a challenge to our own conception of what a superhero is and has to be cognizant of as an African American. And so I look forward to seeing, you know, that discussion expand in terms of what does it mean for, for a woman to be a superhero, and what type of issues resonate within that, and reflection that we see in terms of those dynamics. So I turned a different corner for a moment, but I'll circle back. So when we talk about Isaiah Bradley, one of the things I thought was so interesting was that two comments. One, he makes a statement about no self-respecting, I'm paraphrasing, no self-respecting black man would ever want to wear or be Captain America, right? I mean, that was a bombshell. And then you get Sam Wilson at one point, the Falcon coming back and say, hey, listen, this is a really provocative statement. He says, we built this country, right? And then from there, why will I be denied to fight for it? And so there's an interesting coupling of blackness in terms of a foundation for this, construction of a society, but also this assertion of participation is in fact not only acceptable, but it's actually commendable if you have actually spent your time trying to make the society be the type of society that I guess a Captain America could actually operate in and not feel funny about wearing those stars and stripes.
Adilifu Nama is a professor of African American studies at Loyola Marymount University, and he's written several books on the intersection of pop culture and race. Adilifu, thanks so much for joining us.
Well, thank you for the invitation, and have a good day.
All right, people, that's it for us today. We wanted to take a moment to note that it's April 28th, the 13th anniversary of the very first Takeaway back in 2008. The team, which now includes hundreds of alumni scattered all over the audio world, have made 3,393 shows since that very first, very early morning. Two folks have been here since the beginning, and for the entire run, that's our amazing broadcast engineer and board operator, Vince Fairchild, and our director and sound designer, Jay Cowett, who is, quite frankly, a wizard. Props to them on this anniversary and everyone who has touched this show over the many years, including you out there. You're the reason we're here talking together, and we thank you from the bottom of our hearts for everything. So with that, we'll see you tomorrow for show number 3,394. I'm Nancy Solomon in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.